will dark guarding her day and night, even in the privy. Hasty marriages were arranged for her sisters in sin. Perianne Moore, who was not pregnant, was wed to Jonah Mouton. "You played a part in her ruin, you can be a part of her redemption," the king told the young lordling. The marriage proved to be a success, and in time the two became the lord and lady of Maidenpool. Alice Turnberry, who was pregnant, presented a harder case, as Red Roy Connington refused to marry her. "I will not pretend Stinger's bastard is my son, nor make him the heir to Griffin's Roost," he told the king defiant. Instead, Sweetberry was sent to the Vale to give birth, a girl with bright red hair, at a mother house on an island in Gulltown Harbour, where many lords sent their natural daughters to be raised. Afterwards she was married to Dunstan Prior, the Lord of Pebble, an island off the Fingers. Connington was given a choice between a lifetime in the Night's Watch or 10 years of exile. Unsurprisingly, he chose exile and made his way across the narrow sea to Pentos, and thence to Mere, where he fell in with sellswords and other low company. Only half a year before he might have returned to Westeros, he was stabbed to death by a whore in a Meerish gambling den. The harshest punishment was reserved for Braxton Beesbury, the proud young knight called Stinger. "I could geld you and send you to the war," Jaehaerys told him. "That was how I served Ser Lucamore, and he was a better man than you. I could take your father's lands and castle, but there would be no justice in that. He had no part in what you did, no more than your brothers did. We cannot have you spreading tales about my daughter, though, so we mean to take your tongue, and your nose as well, I think, so you may not find the maids quite so easy to beguile. You are far too proud of your skill with sword and lance, so we will take that away from you as well. We shall break your arms and legs, and my maesters will make certain that they heal crookedly. You will live the rest of your sorry life as a cripple. Unless, Beesbury was as white as chalk. Is there a choice? Any knight accused of wrongdoing has a choice, the king reminded him. You can prove your innocence at hazard of your body.
Then I choose trial by combat, Stinger said. He was by all accounts an arrogant young man, and sure of his skill at arms.
He looked about at the seven Kingsguards standing beneath the iron throne in their long white cloaks and shining scale, and said, "Which of these old men do you mean for me to fight?"
"This old man," announced Jaehaerys Targaryen. "The one whose daughter you seduced and despoiled."
They met the next morning at dawn. The heir to Honeyholt was 19 years of age, the king 49, but still far from an old man. Beesbury armed himself with a morning star, thinking mayhaps that Jaehaerys would be less accustomed to defending himself against that weapon. The king bore Blackfyre. Both men were well armoured and carried shields. When the combat began, Stinger rushed hard at his grace, seeking to overwhelm him with the speed and strength of youth, making the spiked ball whirl and dance and sing. Jaehaerys took every blow on his shield, however, contenting himself with defence, whilst the younger man wore himself out. Soon enough, the time arrived when Braxton Beesbury could scarce lift his arm, and then the king moved to the attack. Even the best of mail is hard-pressed to turn Valyrian steel, and Jaehaerys knew where every weak point could be found. Stinger was bleeding from half a dozen wounds when he finally fell. Jaehaerys kicked his shattered shield away, opened the visor of his helm, laid Blackfyre's point against his eye, and drove it deep. Queen Alysanne did not attend the duel. She told the king she could not bear the thought that he might die. Princess Sarah watched from the window of her cell. Jonquil Dark, her jailer, made certain that she did not turn away. A fortnight later, Jaehaerys and Alysanne gave another of their daughters over to the faith. Princess Sarah, who was not quite 17, departed King's Landing for Old Town, where her sister, Septa Maegel, was to take charge of her instruction. She would be a novice, it was announced, with the Silent Sisters. Septon Barth, who knew the king's mind better than most, would later maintain the sentence was meant to be a lesson. No one could mistake Sarah for her sister Maegel,
least of all her father. She would never be a scepter, much less a silent sister, but she required punishment, and it was thought that a few years of silent prayer, harsh discipline and contemplation would be good for her, that it would set her on the path to redemption. That was not a path that Sarah Targaryen cared to walk, however. The princess endured the silence, the cold baths, the scratchy, rough-spun robes, the meatless meals. She submitted to having her head shaved and being scrubbed with horsehair brushes, and when she was disobedient, she submitted to the cane as well. All this she suffered for a year and a half. But when her chance came in 85 AC, she seized it, fleeing from the mother house in the dead of night and making her way down to the docks. When an older sister came upon her during her escape, she knocked the woman down a flight of steps and leapt over her to the door. When word of her flight reached King's Landing, it was assumed that Sarah would be hiding somewhere in Old Town, but Lord Hightower's men combed the city door to door and no trace was found of her. It was then thought that mayhaps she would make her way back to the Red Keep to beg pardon from her father. When she did not appear there, either, the king wondered if she might not flee to her former friends. So Jonah Mouton and his wife, Perianne, were told to keep watch for her at Maidenpool. The truth did not come out until a year later, when the former princess was seen in a Lycene pleasure garden, still clad as a novice. Queen Alysanne wept to hear it. "They have made our daughter into a whore," she said. "She always was," the king replied. Jaehaerys Targaryen celebrated his 50th name day in 84 AC. The years had taken their toll on him, and those who knew him well said that he was never the same after his daughter Sarah had disgraced and then abandoned him. He had grown thinner, almost gaunt, and there was more grey than gold in his beard now and in his hair. For the first time men were calling him the Old King, rather than the Conciliator. Alysanne, shaken by all the losses they had suffered, withdrew more and more from the governance of the realm and seldom came to council meetings any longer. But Jaehaerys still had his faithful Septon Barth and his sons. "If there is another war," he told the two of them, "it will be for you to fight it. I have my roads to finish." He was better with roads than with daughters, Grand Maester Elisar would write later, in his customary waspish style. In 86 AC, Queen Alysanne announced the betrothal of her daughter Viserra, 15 years of age, to Theomor Manderly, the fierce old lord of White Harbour. The marriage would do much and more to tie the realm together by uniting one of the great houses of the North to the Iron Throne, the king declared. Lord Theomor had won great renown as a warrior in his youth, and had proved himself a canny lord under whose rule White Harbour had prospered greatly. Queen Alysanne was very fond of him as well, remembering the warm welcome he had given her during her first visit to the North. His lordship had outlived 4 wives, however, and whilst still a doughty fighter, he had grown very stout, which did little to recommend him to Princess Viserra. She had a different man in mind. Even as a little girl, Viserra had been the most beautiful of the queen's daughters. Great lords, famous knights, and callow boys had danced attendance on her all her life, feeding her vanity until it became a raging fire. Her great delight in life was playing one boy off against the other, goading them into foolish quests and contests. To win her favour for a joust, she made admiring squires swim the Blackwater Rush, climb the Tower of the Hand, or set free all the ravens in the rookery. Once she took 6 boys to the dragon pit, and told them she would give her maidenhead to whoever put his head in a dragon's mouth. But the gods were good that day, and the dragon keepers put an end to that. No squire was ever going to win Viserra, Queen Alysanne knew. Not her heart, and certainly not her maidenhead. She was far too sly a child to go down the same path as her sister Sarah. "She has no interest in kissing games, nor boys," the queen told Jaehaerys. "She plays with them as she used to play with her puppies, but she would no more lie with one than with a dog. She aims much higher, our Viserra. I have seen the way she preens and prances around Balon. That is the husband she desires, and not for love of him.
She wants to be the queen. Prince Balon was 14 years older than Viserra, 29 to her 15, but older lords had married younger maids, as she well knew. It had been 2 years since Princess Alyssa had died, yet Balon had shown no interest in any other woman. He married one sister. Why not another? Viserra told her closest friend, the empty-headed Beatrice Butterwell. I am much prettier than Alyssa ever was. You saw her. She had a broken nose. If the princess was intent on marrying her brother, the queen was equally determined to prevent it. Her answer was Lord Manderley and White Harbour. Theomore is a good man, Alisande told her daughter, a wise man with a kind heart and a good head on his shoulders. His people love him. The princess was not persuaded. If you like him so much, mother, you should marry him, she said, before running to her father to complain. Jaehaerys offered her no solace. It is a good match, he told her, before explaining the importance of drawing the North closer to the Iron Throne. Marriages were the queen's domain in any case, he said. He never interfered in such matters. Frustrated, Viserra next turned to her brother Balon in hopes of rescue, if court gossip can be believed. Slipping past his guards into his bedchamber one night, she disrobed and waited for him, making free with the prince's wine whilst she lingered. When Prince Balon finally appeared, he found her drunk and naked in his bed and sent her on her way. The princess was so unsteady that she required the help of 2 maids and a knight of the king's guard to get her safely back to her own apartments. How the battle of wills between Queen Alisande and her headstrong 15-year-old daughter might finally have resolved will never be known. Not long after the incident in Balon's bedchamber, as the queen was making arrangements for Viserra's departure from King's Landing, the princess traded clothes with one of her maids to escape the guards who had been assigned to keep her out of mischief, and slipped from the Red Keep for what she termed one last night of laughter before I go and freeze. Her companions were all men, 2 minor lordlings and 4 young knights, all green as spring grass and eager for Viserra's favour. One of them had offered to show the princess parts of the city that she had never seen, the pot-shops and rat-pits of Flea-Bottom, the inns along Eel Alley and River Row where the serving wenches danced on tables, the brothels on the Street of Silk. Ale, mead, and wine all featured in the evening's frolics, and Viserra partook eagerly. At some point, near to midnight, the princess and her remaining companions, several of the knights having become insensible from drink, decided to race back to the castle. A wild ride through the streets of the city ensued, with Kingslanders scrambling out of the way to avoid being run down and trampled. Laughter rang through the night, and spirits were high, until the racers reached the foot of Aegon's High Hill, where Viserra's palfrey collided with one of her companions. The knight's mare lost her footing and fell, breaking his leg beneath her. The princess was thrown from the saddle headfirst into a wall. Her neck was broken. It was the hour of the wolf, the darkest time of the night, when it fell to Sir Ryan Redwine of the King's Guard to rouse the king and queen from their sleep to tell them that their daughter had been found dead in an alley at the foot of Aegon's High Hill. Despite their differences, the loss of Princess Viserra was devastating to the queen. In the space of 5 years, the gods had taken 3 of her daughters, Daella in 82 AC, Alyssa in 84 AC, Viserra in 87 AC. Prince Balon was greatly distraught as well, wondering if he should have spoken to his sister less brusquely the night he found her naked in his bed. Though he and Aemon were a comfort to the king and queen in their time of grief, along with Aemon's wife, the Lady Jocelyn, and their daughter Rhaenys, it was to her own remaining daughters that Alisande turned for solace. Maegel, 25 years of age and a scepter, took leave from her sept to stay with her mother for the rest of that year, and Princess Gale, a sweet, shy child of 7, became the queen's constant shadow and support, even sharing her bed at night. The queen took strength from their presence. But even so, more and more she found her thoughts turning to the daughter who was not with her. Though Jaehaerys had forbidden it, Alisande had defied his edict and secretly engaged agents to keep watch over her wayward child across the narrow sea. Sarah was still in Lys, she knew from their reports, stilled at the pleasure garden. Now 20 years of age, she oft entertained her admirers, still garbed as a novice of the faith. There were evidently a good many Licini who took pleasure in ravishing innocent young women who had taken vows of chastity, even when the innocence was feigned. It was her grief over the loss of Princess Vassera that finally drove the queen to approach Jaehaerys about Sarah once again. She brought Septon Barth along with her to speak on the virtues of forgiveness and the healing properties of time. Only when Barth had finished did her grace mention Sarah's name. "Please," she begged the king, "it is time to bring her home. She has been punished enough, surely. She is our daughter." Jaehaerys would not be moved. "She is a Licini whore," his grace replied. "She opened her legs for half my court, threw an old woman down the steps, and tried to steal a dragon. What more do you require? Have you given any thought as to how she got to Lys? She had no coin. How do you think she paid for her passage?" The queen cringed at the harshness of his words, but still she would not yield. "If you will not bring Sarah home for love of her, bring her home for love of me. I need her."
"You need her as a Dornishman needs a pit viper," Jaehaerys said. "I'm sorry. King's Landing has sufficient whores. I do not wish to hear her name again." With those words he rose to leave, but at the door he halted and turned back. "We have been together since we were children. I know you as well as you know me. Right now you are thinking that you do not need my leave to bring her home, that you can take Silverwing and fly to Lys yourself. What would you do then? Visit her in her pleasure garden? Do you imagine she will fly into your arms and beg forgiveness? She's more like to slap your face. And what will the Licini do if you try and make off with one of their whores? She has value to them. How much do you think it costs to lay with a Targaryen princess? At best, they will demand a ransom for her. At worst, they may decide to keep you too. What will you do then? Shout for Silverwing to burn their city down? Would you have me send Aemon and Balon with an army to see if they can prize her free? You want her. Yes, I hear you. You need her. But she does not need you, or me, or Westeros. She is dead. Bury her." Queen Alysanne did not fly to Lys, but neither did she ever quite forgive the king for the words he spoke that day. Plans had been underway for some time for the two of them to make another progress the following year, returning to the Westerlands for the first time in 20 years. Shortly after their falling out, the queen informed Jaehaerys that he should go alone. She was going back to Dragonstone, alone, to grieve for their dead daughters. And so it was that Jaehaerys Targaryen flew to Casterly Rock and the other great seats of the West alone in 88 AC. This time he even called on Fair Isle, for the despised Lord Franklin was safely in his grave. The king was gone far longer than he had originally intended. He had roadworks to inspect, and he found himself making unplanned stops at smaller towns and castles, delighting many a petty lord and landed knight. Prince Aemon joined him at certain castles, Prince Balon at others, but neither could persuade him to return to the Red Keep. "It has been too long since I have seen my kingdom and listened to my people," his grace told them. "King's Landing will do well enough in your hands and your mother's." When at last he had exhausted the hospitality of the Westermen, he did not return to King's Landing, but moved on directly to the Reach, flying Vermithor from Craighall to Old Oak, to begin a second progress, even as the first was ending. By that time the queen's absence had been noticed, and his grace would oft find himself seated next to some lissome maid or handsome widow at feasts, or riding beside them when hawking or hunting, but he took no notice of any of them. At Band Allen, when Lord Blackbar's youngest daughter was so bold as to seat herself in his lap and attempt to feed him a grape, he brushed her hand aside and said, "Forgive me, but I have a queen, and no taste for paramours." For the entire year of 89 AC, the king remained on the move. At Highgarden he was joined for a time by his granddaughter, Princess Rhaenys, who flew to his side on Melis, the Red Queen. Together they visited the Shield Islands, where the king had never been before. Jaehaerys made a point of landing on all four shields.
It was on Greenshield in Lord Chester's hall that Princess Rhaenys told him of her plans to marry, and received the king's blessing. "You could not have chosen a better man," he said. His journeys finally ended in Oldtown, where he visited with his daughter, Septa Maygale, was blessed by the High Septon and feasted by the Conclave, and enjoyed a tourney staged in his honour by Lord Hightower. Sir Ryan Redwine again emerged as champion. The maesters of that time referred to the estrangement betwixt the king and queen as the Great Rift. The passage of time and a subsequent quarrel that was near as bitter gave it a new name, the First Quarrel. That is how it is known to this day. We shall speak of the Second Quarrel in good time. It was Septa Maygale who bridged the rift. "This is foolish, father," she said to him. "Rhaenys is to be married next year, and it should be a great occasion. She will want all of us there, including both you and mother. The archmaesters call you the conciliator, I have heard. It is time that you conciliated." The scolding had the desired effect. A fortnight later King Jaehaerys returned at last to King's Landing, and Queen Alysanne returned from her own self-imposed exile on Dragonstone. What words passed between them we can never know, but for a good while afterward they were once again as close as they had been before. In the 90th year after Aegon's conquest, the king and queen shared one of their last good times together, as they celebrated the wedding of their eldest grandchild, Princess Rhaenys, to Corlys Valerian of Driftmark, Lord of the Tides. At 7:30 the Sea Snake was already hailed as the greatest seafarer Westeros had ever known, but with his 9 great voyages behind him, he had come home to marry and make a family. "Only you could have won me away from the sea," he told the princess. "I came back from the ends of the earth for you." Rhaenys, at 6 and 10, was a fearless young beauty, and more than a match for her mariner. A dragon rider since the age of 13, she insisted upon arriving for the wedding on Melis, the Red Queen, the magnificent scarlet she-dragon that had once borne her aunt Alyssa. "We can go back to the ends of the earth together," she promised Sir Corlys. "But I'll get there first, as I'll be flying." "That was a good day," Queen Alysanne would say, with a sad smile, through the years that remained to her. She was 54 that year, but sad to say she did not have many good days left. It is not within the scope of this history to chronicle the endless wars, intrigues, and rivalries of the free cities of Essos, save where they impinge upon the fortunes of House Targaryen and the Seven Kingdoms. One such time occurred during the years 91 to 92 AC, during what is known as the Meerish Bloodbath. We shall not trouble you with details. Suffice it to say that in the city of Meer, 2 rival factions vied for supremacy. There were assassinations, riots, poisonings, rapes, hangings, torture, and sea battles before one side emerged supreme. The losing faction, driven from the city, tried to establish themselves first upon the Stepstones, only to be hounded from there as well when the Archon of Tyrosh made common cause with a league of pirate kings. In their desperation, the Mere men next turned to the island of Tarth, where their landings took the Evenstar by surprise. In a short time they had taken the entire eastern side of the island. By that time the Meerish were little more than pirates themselves, a ragged band of rogues. Neither the king nor his council felt it would require much to drive them back into the sea. Prince Aemon would lead the assault, it was decided. The Mere men did have some strength at sea, so the Sea Snake would first need to bring the Valerian fleet south to protect Lord Boromond as he crossed to Tarth with his Stormlanders to join with the Evenstar's own levies. Their combined strength would be more than sufficient to retake all of Tarth from the Meerish pirates, and if there proved to be unexpected difficulties, Prince Aemon would have Caraxes. "He does love to burn," the prince said. Lord Corlys and his fleet set sail from Driftmark on the 9th day of the 3rd moon of 92 AC. Prince Aemon followed a few hours later, after bidding farewell to Lady Jocelyn and their daughter Rhaenys. The princess had just learned she was expecting, else she would have accompanied her sire on Melis. "Into battle?" the prince said. "As if I would ever have permitted that. You have your own battle to fight. Lord Corlys will want a son, I am sure, and I would like a grandson." Those were the last words he would ever speak to his daughter. Caraxes swiftly outdistanced the sea snake and his fleet, dropping down out of the sky on Tarth. Lord Cameron, the even star of Tarth, had fallen back into the spine of mountains that ran down the centre of his island, and established a camp in a hidden valley, from which he could look down on the Mirish movements below. Prince Aemon met him there, and the two made plans together whilst Caraxes devoured half a dozen goats. But the Evenstar's camp was not as hidden as he hoped, and the smoke from the dragon's fires drew the eyes of a pair of Mirish scouts who were creeping through the heights unawares. One of them recognized the Evenstar as he strode through the camp at dusk, talking with Prince Aemon. The men of Mir are indifferent, sailors and feeble soldiers. Their weapons of choice are dirk, dagger, and crossbow, preferably poisoned. One of the Mirish scouts wound his crossbow now, behind the rocks where he was hidden. Rising, he took aim on the Evenstar 100 yards below and loosed his bolt. Dusk and distance made his aim less certain, and the bolt missed Lord Cameron and struck Prince Aemon, standing at his side. The iron bolt punched through the prince's throat and out the back of his neck. The Prince of Dragonstone fell to his knees and grasped the crossbow bolt as if to pull it from his throat, but his strength was gone. Aemon Targaryen died, struggling to speak, drowned on his own blood. He was 37 years old. How can my words tell of the grief that swept the Seven Kingdoms then, of the pain felt by King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne, of Lady Jocelyn's empty bed and bitter tears, and the way Princess Rhaenys wept to know that her father would never hold the child she was carrying. Far easier to speak of Prince Balon's wrath, and how he came down upon Tarth, on Vhagar, howling for vengeance. The Mirish ships burned as Prince Morion's ships had burned 9 years earlier, and when the Evenstar and Lord Boromund descended on them from the mountains, they had nowhere to fly. They were cut down by the thousands and left to rot along the beaches, so every wave that washed ashore for days was tinged with pink. Balon the Brave played his part in the slaughter, with Dark Sister in his hand. When he returned to King's Landing with his brother's corpse, the small folk lined the streets, screaming his name and hailing him as a hero. But it is said that when he saw his mother again, he fell into her arms and wept. "I slew 1,000 of them," he said, "but it will not bring him back." And the queen stroked his hair and said, "I know, I know." Seasons came and went in the years that followed. There were hot days and warm days and days when the salt wind blew bracing off the sea. There were fields of flowers in the spring and bountiful harvests and golden autumn afternoons. All across the realm the roads crept onward and new bridges spanned old streams. The king took no pleasure in any of it, so far as men could tell. "It is always winter now," he said to Septon Barth one night, when he had drunk too much. Since Aemon's death, he always drank a cup or three of honeyed wine at night to help him sleep. In 93 AC, Prince Balon's 16-year-old son, Viserys, entered the dragon pit and claimed Beleriand. The old dragon had stopped growing at last, but he was sluggish and heavy and hard to rouse, and he struggled when Viserys urged him up into the air. The young prince flew thrice around the city before landing again. He had intended to fly to Dragonstone, he told his father afterward, but he did not think the Black Dread had the strength for it. Less than a year later, Beleriand was gone. "The last living creature in all the world who saw Valyria in its glory," wrote Septon Barth. Barth himself died 4 years later, in 98 AC. Grand Maester Elizar preceded him by half a year. Lord Redwine had died in 89 AC, his son Sir Robert soon thereafter. New men took their places. But Jaehaerys was truly the old king by then, and sometimes he would walk into the council chamber and think, "Who are these men? Do I know them?" His grace grieved for Prince Aemon until the end of his days. But the old king never dreamed that Aemon's death in 92 AC would be like the hell horns of Valyrian legend, bringing death and destruction down on all those who heard their sound.
The last years of Alysanne Targaryen were sad and lonely ones. In her youth, good Queen Alysanne had loved her subjects, lords and commons alike. She had loved her women's courts, listening, learning, and doing what she could to make the realm a kinder place. She had seen more of the Seven Kingdoms than any queen before or since, slept in 100 castles, charmed 100 lords, made 100 marriages. She had loved music, had loved to dance, had loved to read, and oh, how she had loved to fly. Silverwing had carried her to Old Town, to the Wall, and to 1,000 places in between. And Alysanne saw them all as few others ever would, looking down from above the clouds. All these loves were lost to her in the last decade of her life. "My uncle Maegor was cruel," Alysanne was heard to say, "but age is crueler." Worn out from childbirth, travel and grief, she grew thin and frail after Aemon's death. Climbing hills became a trial to her, and in 95 AC she slipped and fell on the Serpentine Steps, breaking her hip. Thereafter she walked with a cane. Her hearing began to fail as well. Music was lost to her, and when she tried to sit in council meetings with the king, she could no longer understand half of what was said. She was far too unsteady to fly. Silverwing last carried her into the sky in 93 AC. When she came to earth again and climbed painfully from her dragon's back, the queen wept. More than all of these, she had loved her children. "No mother ever loved a child more," Grand Maester Benefar once told her, before the shivers carried him away. In the last days of her life, Queen Alysanne reflected on his words. "He was wrong, I think," she wrote, "for surely the mother above loved my children more. She took so many of them away from me." "No mother should ever have to burn her child," the queen had said at the funeral pyre of her son Valerian. But of the 13 children she bore to King Jaehaerys, only 3 of them would survive her. Aegon, Gaemon, and Valerian died as babes. The shivers took Daenerys at the age of 6. A crossbow slew Prince Aemon. Alyssa and Daela died in childbed. Viserra drunk in the street. Septa Maegel, that gentle soul, died in 96 AC, her arms and legs turned to stone by grayscale, for she had spent her last years nursing those afflicted with that horrible condition. Saddest of all was the loss of Princess Gale, the winter child, born in 80 AC when Queen Alysanne was 44 and thought to be well past her childbearing years. A sweet-natured girl, but frail and somewhat simple-minded, she remained with the queen long after her other children had grown and gone. But in 99 AC she vanished from court, and soon afterward it was announced that she had died of a summer fever. Only after both her parents were gone did the true tale come out. Seduced and abandoned by a travelling singer, the princess had given birth to a stillborn son, then, overwhelmed by grief, walked into the waters of Blackwater Bay and drowned. Some say that Alysanne never recovered from that loss, for her winter child alone had been a true companion during her declining years. Sarah still lived, somewhere in Volantis. She had departed Lys some years before, an infamous woman, but a wealthy one. But she was dead to Jaehaerys, and the letters Alysanne sent her secretly from time to time all went unanswered. Vagon was an archmaester of the Citadel. A cold and distant son, he had grown to be a cold and distant man. He wrote, as a son ought. His words were dutiful, but there was no warmth to them, and it had been years since Alysanne had last seen his face. Only Balon the Brave remained near her till the end. Her spring prince visited her as often as he could, and always won a smile from her, but Balon was the Prince of Dragonstone, hand of the king, forever coming and going, sitting at his father's side at council, treating with the lords. "You will be a great king, even greater than your father," Alysanne told him the last time they were together. She did not know. How could she know? After the death of Princess Gale, King's Landing and the Red Keep became unbearable to Alysanne. She could no longer serve as she once had, as a partner to the king in his labours, and the court was full of strangers whose names Alysanne could not quite recall.
Seeking peace, she returned once more to Dragonstone, where she had spent the happiest days of her life with Jaehaerys, between their first and second marriages. The old king would join her there when he could. "How is it that I am the old king now, but you are still the good queen?" he asked her once. Alysanne laughed. "I am old as well, but I am still younger than you." Alysanne Targaryen died on Dragonstone on the first day of the seventh moon in 100 AC, a full century after Aegon's conquest. She was 64 years old. Heirs of the Dragon, A Question of Succession. The seeds of war are oft planted during times of peace. So has it been in Westeros. The bloody struggle for the Iron Throne, known as the Dance of the Dragons, fought from 129 to 131 AC, had its roots half a century earlier, during the longest and most peaceful reign that any of the Conqueror's descendants ever enjoyed, that of Jaehaerys I Targaryen, the Conciliator. The old king and good queen Alysanne ruled together until her death in 100 AC, aside from two periods of estrangement known as the First and Second Quarrels, and produced 13 children. Four of them, two sons and two daughters, grew to maturity, married and produced children of their own. Never before or since had the Seven Kingdoms been blessed, or cursed, in the view of some, with so many Targaryen princelings. From the loins of the old king and his beloved queen sprang such a confusion of claims and claimants that many maesters believed that the Dance of the Dragons, or some similar struggle, was inevitable. This was not apparent in the early years of Jaehaerys' reign, for in Prince Aemon and Prince Balon his grace had the proverbial heir and a spare, and seldom has the realm been blessed with two more able princes. In 62 AC, at the age of 7, Aemon was formally anointed Prince of Dragonstone and heir to the Iron Throne. Knighted at 17, a tourney champion at 20, he became his father's justiciar and master of laws at 6 and 20. Though he never served his father as Hand of the King, that was only because that office was occupied by Septon Barth, the old king's most trusted friend and companion of my labours. Nor was Balon Targaryen any less accomplished. The younger prince earned his knighthood at 16 and was wed at 18. Though he and Aemon enjoyed a healthy rivalry, no man doubted the love that bound them. The succession appeared solid as stone. But the stone began to crack in 92 AC, when Aemon, Prince of Dragonstone, was slain on Tarth by a Meerish crossbow bolt loosed at the man beside him. The king and queen mourned his loss and the realm with them, but no man was more bereft than Prince Balon, who went at once to Tarth and avenged his brother by driving the Mere Men into the sea. On his return to King's Landing, Balon was hailed as a hero by cheering throngs, and embraced by his father the king, who named him Prince of Dragonstone and heir to the Iron Throne. It was a popular decree. The small folk loved Balon the Brave, and the lords of the realm saw him as his brother's obvious successor. But Prince Aemon had a child. His daughter, Rhaenys, born in 74 AC, had grown into a clever, capable, and beautiful young woman. In 90 AC, at the age of 16, she had wed the king's admiral and master of ships, Corlys of House Valerian, Lord of the Tide, known as the Sea Snake after the most famous of his many ships. Moreover, Princess Rhaenys was with child when her father died. By granting Dragonstone to Prince Balon, King Jaehaerys was not only passing over Rhaenys, but also, possibly, her unborn son. The king's decision was in accord with well-established practice. Aegon the Conqueror had been the first lord of the Seven Kingdoms, not his sister Visenya, 2 years his elder. Jaehaerys himself had followed his usurping uncle Maegor on the Iron Throne, though had the order of birth alone ruled, his sister Rhaena had a better claim. Jaehaerys did not make his decision lightly. He is known to have discussed the matter with his small council. Undoubtedly he consulted Septon Barth, as he did on all important matters, and the views of Grand Maester Elisar were given much weight. All were in accord. Balon, a seasoned knight of 35, was better suited for rule than the 18-year-old Princess Rhaenys, or her unborn babe, who might or might not be a boy, whereas Prince Balin had already sired two healthy sons, Viserys and Daemon. The love of the commons for Balon the Brave was also cited. Some dissented. Rhaenys herself was the first to raise objection. "You would rob my son of his birthright," she told the king, with a hand upon her swollen belly. Her husband, Corlys Velaryon, was so wroth that he gave up his admiralty and his place on the small council and took his wife back to Driftmark. Lady Jocelyn of House Baratheon, Rhaenys's mother, was also angered, as was her formidable brother, Boromund, Lord of Storm's End. The most prominent dissenter was good Queen Alysanne, who had helped her husband rule the Seven Kingdoms for many years and now saw her son's daughter being passed over because of her sex. "A ruler needs a good head and a true heart," she famously told the king. "A cock is not essential. If your grace truly believes that women lack the wit to rule, plainly you have no further need of me." And thus Queen Alysanne departed King's Landing and flew to Dragonstone on her dragon Silverwing. She and King Jaehaerys remained apart for 2 years, the period of estrangement recorded in the histories as the Second Quarrel. The old king and the good queen were again reconciled in 94 AC by the good offices of their daughter, Septa Maegaer, but never reached accord on the succession. The queen died of a wasting illness in 100 AC at the age of 64, still insisting that her granddaughter Rhaenys and her children had been unfairly cheated of their rights. The boy in the belly, the unborn child who had been the subject of so much debate, proved to be a girl when born in 93 AC. Her mother named her Laena. The next year, Rhaenys gave her a brother, Laenor. Prince Balon was firmly ensconced as heir apparent by then, yet House Valerian and House Baratheon clung to the belief that young Laenor had a better claim to the Iron Throne. And some few even argued for the rights of his elder sister, Laena, and their mother, Rhaenys. In the last years of her life, the gods dealt Queen Alysanne many cruel blows, as has previously been recounted. Her grace knew joys as well as sorrows during the same years, however, chief amongst them her grandchildren. There were weddings as well. In 93 AC she attended the wedding of Prince Balon's eldest son, Viserys, to Lady Emma of House Arryn, the 11-year-old child of the late Princess Stella. Their marriage was not consummated until the bride had flowered 2 years later. In 97, the good queen saw Balon's second son, Daemon, take to wife Lady Rhea of House Royce, heir to the ancient castle of Runestone in the Vale. The great tourney held at King's Landing in 98 AC to celebrate the 50th year of King Jaehaerys' reign surely gladdened the queen's heart as well, for most of her surviving children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren returned to share in the feasts and celebrations. Not since the doom of Illyria had so many dragons been seen in one place at one time, it was truly said. The final tilt, wherein the Kingsguard knights Sir Ryan Redwine and Sir Clement Crabb broke 30 lances against each other before King Jaehaerys proclaimed them co-champions, was declared to be the finest display of jousting ever seen in Westeros. A fortnight after the tourney's end, however, the king's old friend Septon Barth died peacefully in his sleep after serving ably as Hand of the King for 41 years. Jaehaerys chose the Lord Commander of his King's Guard to take his place, but Sir Ryan Redwine was no Septon Barth, and his undoubted prowess with a lance proved of little use to him as Hand. "Some problems cannot be solved by hitting them with a stick," Grand Maester Allar famously observed. His Grace had no choice but to remove Sir Ryan after only a year in office. He turned to his son Balon to replace him, and in 99 AC the Prince of Dragonstone became the King's Hand as well. He performed his duties admirably. Though less scholarly than Septon Barth, the Prince proved a good judge of men, and surrounded himself with loyal subordinates and counsellors. The realm would be well ruled when Balon Targaryen sat the Iron Throne, lords and common folk agreed. It was not to be. In 101 AC, Prince Balon complained of a stitch in his side, whilst hunting in the Kingswood. The pain worsened when he returned to the city. His belly swelled and hardened, and the pain grew so severe it left him bedridden. Ransitor, the new Grand Maester, only recently arrived from the Citadel after Allah was felled by a stroke, was able to bring the prince's fever down somewhat and give him some relief from agony with milk of the poppy, but his condition continued to worsen. On the fifth day of his illness, Prince Balon died in his bedchamber in the Tower of the Hand, with his father sitting beside him holding his hand. After opening the corpse, Grand Maester Ransitor put down the cause of death as a burst belly. All the seven kingdoms wept for brave Balon, and none more so than King Jaehaerys. This time, when he lit his son's funeral pyre, he did not even have the comfort of his beloved wife beside him. The old king had never been so alone. And now again his grace faced a nettlesome dilemma, for once more the succession was in doubt. With both of the heirs apparent dead and burned, there was no longer a clear successor to the Iron Throne. But that was not to say there was any lack of claimants. Balon had sired three sons by his sister Alyssa. Two, Viserys and Daemon, still lived. Had Balon ever taken the Iron Throne, Viserys would have followed him without question, but the Crown Prince's tragic death at the age of 40 muddied the succession. The claims of Princess Rhaenys and her daughter, Laena Valerian, were put forward once again, and even if they were to be passed over on account of their sex, Rhaenys's son Laenor faced no such impediment. Laenor Valerian was male and could claim descent from Jaehaerys's elder son, whilst Balon's boys were descended from the younger. Moreover, King Jaehaerys still had one surviving son, Vaegon, an archmaester at the Citadel, holder of the ring and rod and mask of yellow gold. Known to history as Vaegon the Dragonless, his very existence had been largely forgotten by most of the Seven Kingdoms. Though only 40 years of age, Vaegon was pale and frail, a bookish man devoted to alchemy, astronomy, mathematics, and other arcane arts. Even as a boy, he had never been well-liked. Few considered him a viable choice to sit the Iron Throne. And yet it was to Archmaester Vaegon that the old king turned now, summoning his last son to King's Landing. What passed between them remains a matter of dispute. Some say the king offered Vaegon the throne and was refused. Others assert that he only sought his counsel. Reports had reached the court that Corlys Valerian was massing ships and men on Driftmark to defend the rights of his son Laenor, whilst Daemon Targaryen, a hot-tempered and quarrelsome young man of 20, had gathered his own band of sworn swords in support of his brother Viserys. A violent struggle for succession was likely no matter who the old king named to succeed him. No doubt that was why his grace seized eagerly on the solution offered by Archmaester Vaegon. King Jaehaerys announced his intent to convene a great council to discuss, debate, and ultimately decide the matter of succession. All the great and lesser lords of Westeros would be invited to attend, together with maesters from the Citadel of Old Town, and septers and septons to speak for the faith. Let the claimants make their cases before the assembled lords, his grace decreed. He would abide by the council's decision, whomever they might choose. It was decided that the council would be held at Harrenhal, the largest castle in the realm. No one knew how many lords would come, since no such council had ever been held before, but it was thought prudent to have room for at least 500 lords and their tails. More than 1,000 lords attended. It took half a year for them to assemble. A few arrived even as the council was breaking up. Even Harrenhal could not contain such multitudes, for each lord was accompanied by a retinue of knights, squires, grooms, cooks, and serving men. Tymond Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock, brought 300 men with him. Not to be outdone, Lord Matthos Tyrell of Highgarden brought 500. Lords came from every corner of the realm, from the Dornish Marches to the Shadow of the Wall, from the Three Sisters to the Iron Islands. The Evenstar of Tarth was there, and the Lord of the Lonely Light. From Winterfell came Lord Ellard Stark, from Riverrun, Lord Grover Tully, from the Vale, Yorbert Royce, regent and protector for young Jane Arryn, Lady of the Eyrie. Even the Dornish men were represented. The Prince of Dorne sent his daughter and 20 Dornish knights to Harrenhal as observers. The High Septon came from Old Town to bless the assembly. Merchants and tradesmen descended upon Harrenhal by the hundreds. Hedge knights and free riders came in hopes of finding work for their swords. Cutpurses came seeking after coin. Old women and young girls came seeking after husbands. Thieves and whores, washerwomen and camp followers, singers and mummers, they came from east and west and north and south. A city of tents sprang up outside the walls of Harrenhal and along the lake shore for leagues in each direction. For a time, Harrington was the fourth city in the realm. Only Old Town, King's Landing, and Lannisport were larger. No fewer than 14 claims were duly examined and considered by the lords assembled. From Essos came 3 rival competitors, grandsons of King Jaehaerys through his daughter Sarah, each sired by a different father. One was said to be the very image of his grandsire in his youth. Another, a bastard born to a triarch of Old Volantis, arrived with bags of gold and a dwarf elephant. The lavish gifts he distributed amongst the poorer lords undoubtedly helped his claim. The elephant proved less useful. Princess Sarah herself was still alive and well in Volantis, at only 34 years of age. Her own claim was clearly superior to those of any of her bastard sons, but she did not choose to press it. "I have my own kingdom here," she said, when asked if she meant to return to Westeros. Another contestant produced sheafs of parchment that demonstrated his descent from Gaemon the Glorious, the greatest of the Targaryen lords of Dragonstone before the conquest, by way of a younger daughter and the petty lord she had married, and on for 7 further generations. There was as well a strapping red-haired man-at-arms who claimed to be a bastard son of Maegor the Cruel. By way of proof, he brought his mother, an aged innkeep's daughter who said that she had once been raped by Maegor. The lords were prepared to believe the fact of rape, but not that the act had gotten her with child. The Great Council deliberated for 13 days. The tenuous claims of 9 lesser competitors were considered and discarded. One such, a hedge knight who put himself forward as a natural son of King Jaehaerys himself, was seized and imprisoned when the king exposed him as a liar. Archmaester Vagon was ruled out on account of his vows, and Princess Rhaenys and her daughter on account of their sex, leaving the 2 claimants with the most support. Viserys Targaryen, eldest son of Prince Balon and Princess Alyssa, and Laenor Valerian, the son of Princess Rhaenys and grandson of Prince Aemon. Viserys was the old king's grandson, Laenor his great-grandson. The principle of primogeniture favoured Laenor, the principle of proximity Viserys. Viserys had also been the last Targaryen to ride Balerion, though after the death of the Black Dread in 94 AC he never mounted another dragon, whereas the boy Laenor had yet to take his first flight upon his young dragon, a splendid grey-and-white beast he named Sea Smoke. But Viserys's claim derived from his father, Laenor's from his mother, and most lords felt that the male line must take precedence over the female. Moreover, Viserys was a man of 24, Laenor a boy of 7. For all these reasons, Laenor's claim was generally regarded as the weaker. But the boy's mother and father were such powerful and influential figures that it could not be dismissed entirely. Mayhaps this would be a good place to add a few additional words about his sire, Corlys of House Valerian, Lord of the Tides and Master of Driftmark, renowned in song and story as the Sea Snake and surely one of the most extraordinary figures of the age. A noble house with a storied Valyrian lineage, the Valyrians had come to Westeros even before the Targaryens, if their family histories can be believed, settling in the gullet on the low-lying and fertile isle of Driftmark, so named for the driftwood that the tides brought daily to its shores, rather than its stony, smoking neighbour Dragonstone. Though never dragon-riders, the Valyrians had for centuries remained the oldest and closest allies of the Targaryens. The sea was their element, not the sky. During the conquest it was Valyrian ships that carried Aegon's soldiers across Blackwater Bay, and later formed the greater part of the royal fleet. Throughout the first century of Targaryen rule, so many Lords of the Tides served on the small council as master of ships that the office was widely seen as almost hereditary. Yet even with such forebears, Corlys Valerian was a man apart, a man as brilliant as he was restless, as adventurous as he was ambitious. It was traditional for the sons of the Seahorse, the sigil of House Valerian, to be given a taste of a seafarer's life when young, but no Valerian before or since ever took to shipboard life as eagerly as the boy who would become the Sea Snake. He first crossed the Narrow Sea at the age of 6, sailing to Pentos with an uncle. Thereafter, Corlys made such voyages every year. Nor did he travel as a passenger. He climbed masts, tied knots, scrubbed decks, pulled oars, caulked leaks, raised and lowered sails, manned the crow's nest, learned to navigate and steer. His captains said they had never seen such a natural sailor. At age 16, he became a captain himself, taking a fishing boat called the Cod Queen from Driftmark to Dragonstone and back. In the years that followed, his ships grew larger and swifter, his voyages longer and more dangerous. He took ships around the bottom of Westeros to visit Oldtown, Lannisport, and Lordsport on Pike. He sailed to Lys, Tyrosh, Pentos, and Myr. He took the Summer Maid to Volantis and the Summer Isles, and the Ice Wolf north to Braavos, east watched by the sea and Hardhome, before turning into the Shivering Sea for Lorath and the port of Ibben. On a later voyage, he and the Ice Wolf headed north once more, searching for a rumoured passage around the top of Westeros, but finding only frozen seas and icebergs big as mountains. His most famous voyages were those he made on the ship that he designed and built himself, the Sea Snake. Traders from Old Town and the Arbor oft sailed as far as Carth, in search of spice, silk, and other treasures, but Corlys Valerian and the Sea Snake were the first to go beyond, passing through the Jade Gates to Yi Ti and the Isle of Lung, returning with so rich a load of silk and spice that he doubled the wealth of House Valerian in a stroke. On his second voyage in the Sea Snake, he sailed even farther, to Ashai by the Shadow. On his third, he tried the Shivering Sea instead, becoming the first Westerosi to navigate the Thousand Islands and visit the bleak, cold shores of Ungai and Mossavi. In the end, the Sea Snake made 9 voyages. On the 9th, Sir Corlys took her back to Carth, laden with enough gold to buy 20 more ships, and load them all with saffron, pepper, nutmeg, elephants, and bolts of the finest silk. Only 14 of the fleet arrived safely at Driftmark, and all the elephants died at sea. Yet even so, the profits from that voyage were so vast that the Valerians became the wealthiest house in the 7 kingdoms, eclipsing even the Hightowers and Lannisters, albeit briefly. This wealth Sir Corlys put to good use when his aged grandsire died at the age of 88, and the Sea Snake became Lord of the Tides. The seat of House Valerian was Castle Driftmark, a dark, grim place, always damp and often flooded. Lord Corlys raised a new castle on the far side of the island. High Tide was built of the same pale stone as the Eyrie, its slender towers crowned with roofs of beaten silver that flashed in the sun. When the morning and evening tides rolled in, the castle was surrounded by the sea, connected to Driftmark proper only by a causeway. To this new castle, Lord Corlys moved the ancient Driftwood throne, a gift from the Merlin King, according to legend. The Sea Snake built ships as well. The royal fleet tripled in size during the years he served the old king as master of ships. Even after giving up that office, he continued to build, turning out merchantmen and trading galleys in place of warships. Beneath the dark, salt-stained walls of Castle Driftmark, 3 modest fishing villages grew together into a thriving town called Hull, for the rows of ship hulls that could always be seen below the castle. Across the island, near High Tide, another village was transformed into Spice Town, its wharves and piers crowded with ships from the free cities and beyond. Sitting athwart the gullet, Driftmark was closer to the Narrow Sea than Duskendale or King's Landing, so Spice Town soon began to use up much of the shipping that would elsewise have made for those ports, and House Valerian grew ever richer and more powerful. Lord Corlys was an ambitious man. During his 9 voyages on the Sea Snake, he was forever wanting to press onward, to go where none had gone before and see what lay beyond the maps. Though he had accomplished much and more in life, he was seldom satisfied, the men who knew him best would say. In Rhaenys Targaryen, daughter of the old king's eldest son and heir, he had found his perfect match, a woman as spirited and beautiful and proud as any in the realm, and a dragon rider as well. His sons and daughters would soar through the skies, Lord Corlys expected, and one day,
One of them would sit the Iron Throne. Unsurprisingly, the Sea Snake was bitterly disappointed when Prince Aemon died and King Jaehaerys bypassed Aemon's daughter Rhaenys in favour of his